If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. Millions of years ago, Africa was the cradle of humanity. But the continent's deep and rich history has long been downplayed in Western narratives. Zainab Badawi spoke to Danny Bird about her new book, which seeks to explore the continent's story through the eyes and voices of Africans themselves. From the ancient civilizations of Egypt, to the overlooked deeds of some of Africa's great men and women, to the transatlantic slave trade and the independence of nations in modern times.
You've written an epic, ambitious and rich history of Africa, spanning a vast sweep of cultures, regions, personalities and centuries. But before we get into some of those aspects, can I ask you if you sought out any particular stories or narratives in preparation for this book? And was there anything that surprised you along the way?
So when I set about writing this book, it wasn't so much that I was looking for an angle. The angle found me. And by that I mean that I was embarked on a journey around Africa, in fact, to make a television history series. And I spoke to dozens and dozens of historians, archaeologists and anthropologists right across the continent. And without exception, every single one of these academics was so generous with their time, I had to tear myself away from them on every occasion. They just would have sat talking to me about their particular subject until the cows came home. And so I thought to myself, these people are really hungry for a stage, a global stage even. They wanted to relate their history to outsiders. And therefore, I decided to write a history book about Africa, written from the African perspective. And that really is the key angle. So in a way, although it says An African History of Africa by Zainab Badawi, truly, I see myself more as a kind of intercessor between the reader and these marvelous African scholars and intellectuals. And I say marvelous because every single one of them would be at home in any of the world's finest academic institutions. And in fact, many of them have studied in the world's top universities, but gone home to apply their trade there. So that was my angle. I wanted to bring their perspective.
Now, Africa is an enormous landmass and has been home to many great civilizations across several millennia. What are the benefits and the disadvantages, perhaps, of tackling an entire continent's history?
Well, I mean, obviously, I only skim the surface and I am selective. You have to be, otherwise there'll be volumes and volumes and volumes of the book. But I think that I have tried and I think I have succeeded to a large extent in trying to ensure that North, South, East, West and Central Africa are covered at some stage in the book. And I think it was the right approach because I personally don't like this division that has often existed between North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. And people tend to just relegate North Africa to the Arab world. And of course, it's part of the Arab world, but that doesn't mean that it isn't also part of Africa. So I therefore think it was right that I covered the entire continent from tip to toe. And I try to focus on personalities from each of these regions because I think history is better understood when it's seared into the imagination and it's best to do that through characters. And I think you will emerge from reading this book with a greater, deeper understanding of Africa, hopefully, than you would have had before. But more importantly, I hope I will excite curiosity for the reader to want to find out more about any particular aspect that especially interested them.
Your book aspires to centre African voices in the telling of their own history, as you've just spelt out. Do you think this yields a more authentic understanding of a place?
I do think it's absolutely important that when you look at Africa's history, you look at it through the lens of Africans themselves. and moreover from Africans from that region, because Africa obviously isn't a country, it's made up of 54 countries. So if you are looking at the history of the people of Central Africa, then it makes sense to talk to people from the Congo today, from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, as well as Congo Brazzaville, etc. And I think that's super important because you gain a much better understanding. And if you look at Africa through a Western lens all the time, you'll find some things quite baffling and beyond comprehension. But that's because the value systems, the traditional beliefs are quite different. So I do believe that in bringing the perspective of the African historian or archaeologist to the fore in this way, that they bring something different to the table from the Africanists. I mean, there are many great Africanists and they've written some marvelous books, but I do think that the indigenous academic scholar brings, I think, just that little extra quality. Plus, they understand oral tradition, and so much of Africa's history, as we try to piece it together, has to derive from oral tradition, and they often grew up with these stories themselves.
That leads on to my next question, which is, could you tell us a little bit about the work of the General History of Africa project and how important that was to your own research?
This actually, to be perfectly honest, was probably the one project that got me interested in this whole journey. And it's really what provided me with an angle. Yes, the angle was kind of presented to me when I spoke to lots of African academics, but essentially my compass and my northern star was the General History of Africa. This was an amazing project. It's one of Africa's best kept secrets. And I found out about it by chance, really. I was visiting the headquarters of the offices of UNESCO, the United Nations Education, Scientific and Cultural Organization in Paris. And I was in the office of the then Deputy Director General, a wonderful Ethiopian man called Getachew Engida. And as I was talking to him, I looked at the bookcase behind him and I saw about 9 or 10 volumes of books called The General History of Africa. And I said to him, Getachew, what are these books? And he said, the General History of Africa is Africa's history written by Africans, and it's all in 9 volumes. I said, tell me more. And so he said that in the early 1960s, during that period of rapid decolonization in Africa, the newly independent African leaders, or at least some of them, said to themselves, look, we've decolonized our countries. We want to decolonize our history. So they approached UNESCO, who assisted them in this project, and put together a committee to basically write the history of Africa using, for the most part, African scholars. They scoured the continent for the best experts in history, archaeology, anthropology, paleontology. They used sources which Western historians hadn't used, from Arabic, Persian. They used oral tradition, music and dance and lots of other creative expressions. And they put together 9 volumes of Africa's history, starting from the origins of humankind to the modern era. And I used this as a source for a lot of my work. The volumes are wonderful, but they are written in a fairly turgid way, so not the easiest of reads, which is why I wanted to write something in a more accessible fashion.
And you mentioned there paleontology, and the fact that, of course, Africa is the cradle of humanity. And in fact, you begin your book millions of years ago at the dawn of our species. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what it was like to come face to face with some of the fossils of our earliest ancestors.
As I say in the book, I was full of nervous excitement because I was about to meet a superstar, albeit one that had been dead for millions of years. And that was, of course, Lucy, or to use her name in the Amharic language of Ethiopia, Dinkanesh, which means you are marvelous. So Lucy was really a standout meet for me. And sadly, in Addis Ababa at the National Museum, they can't leave her original bones on display because obviously they would deteriorate. So I was very privileged to be taken into a special room, climatically controlled, and the attendant, with great reverence, opened the drawers, having unlocked the door with military precision. And so I saw these bones with one of Ethiopia's leading paleontologists. So, yeah, it was absolutely marvelous to see Dinkanesh completely. But, I mean, funnily enough, her line didn't exactly lead to the line that we humans descended from, but she's all part of this ever-evolving story of the origins of humankind. But I wanted to start the book there because I say on the back of my book, everyone is originally from Africa, therefore this book is for everyone, because the science is settled. Everybody agrees that we all came out of Africa. There may be some dispute about which part of the continent, but if you're not African or descended from an African today, you are an African export. And I think that that was a good starting point for me. And it's also, I think, a useful reminder in a world where we talk so much about racial differences to remind ourselves that we all came from the same place. And actually, differences in colour emerged very recently, between 8,000 to 12,000 years ago.
I was also struck by several instances in your book where you write about your expectation of places like Timbuktu and the ruins of Carthage being challenged. And I just wondered, how did your perception of Africa and your own heritage change whilst you were creating this book?
I was born in the Sudan, but I've lived in the UK since I was 2, going on 3 years of age. So I wanted to write this book because it was essentially the kind of book I would have liked to have read myself, to find out about Africa in a sort of one-stop shop, or at least to get a decent overview. And so when I embarked on this journey of research, I didn't have sort of preconceived perceptions. I had a very, very open mind. But I would say that I was surprised by the richness of the continent's history, and especially by the history of the country where I was born, the Sudan, which has 1,000 pyramids. Egypt has 100. 1,000 in Sudan, although only 300 preserved their superstructure. So I was really quite blown away by the statues of the kings of ancient Sudan and the tombs and some of the artifacts and so on. So I think that it may be because I had a greater attachment to Sudan that that probably was the one area of research which really surprised me in a very pleasant way.
Something you've just touched upon there is that your book is quite passionate in spotlighting some of Africa's long overlooked great men and women. And I was wondering if you could tell us about some of these individuals and their achievements.
I think if you ask most people to name figures from Africa's history, let's forget about the modern era. People have heard of Nelson Mandela, Robert Mugabe, Jomo Kenyatta and so on. But I wanted to look at Africa's history, the hidden part. And so I think if you ask most people, what do you know about Africa's history before, say, the 19th century, and name a king or a queen, they'd be hard-pressed. They might come up with Tutankhamun. They might come up with perhaps Shaka, king of the Zulus, but not really much more than that. So I decided I wanted to really tell the story of Africa through personalities insofar as I could, and to try and focus on women where I could as well, because I think often their role in history is overlooked. I mean, there's some marvellous characters I encountered on the way. King Taharqo, who was the king of Kush in ancient Sudan in the 7th century BCE, who's named in the Bible. I mean, he was a great tactician and soldier and a very, very effective ruler, and under him, the kingdom of Kush became a regional superpower. He was protector of various kings and princes in Western Asia. So he was a very colourful figure. The women I loved, Queen Njinga, she ruled over the Ndongo kingdom in what would be part of Angola today. And she was born in the late 1500s and died in the 1600s. She fought the Portuguese. She was marked out for greatness when she was born because she came out feet first. And apparently this was a sign that she would go far. And she outwitted the Portuguese on numerous occasions. And even when she was in her 40s, when she was being pursued by Portuguese soldiers and she came to a rocky precipice and didn't know what to do, she abseiled using a vine. She abseiled across and managed to get to the other side, and the Portuguese soldiers chasing her just fell to their deaths. So she was a woman of great courage. I love Ya Asantewaa, the 19th century Asante queen in what is today Ghana, who the men of Asante she thought were being a bit cowardly in trying to fight the British, and she admonished them and said, "You are all cowards. You should exchange your loincloths for my undergarments." And so she became a real national icon once Ghana became independent. So there are so many colourful characters I encountered in my research and about whom I was told by the people I interviewed.
Thank you very much. I think as well as the significant people you've just highlighted, it did make me curious to learn more about whether there's been any headway with African social history.
The slight impediment to that is the fact that Africa's oral tradition will extol the deeds and the virtues of their leaders, be they men or women. So there's a great emphasis in oral tradition on the actions of great people. So the social history is a bit harder to uncover what ordinary people did and how they functioned and so on. But I do look at social structures and how people were governed. I do look at African traditional beliefs and religions and how they ordered their societies. And so I try to do that where I can.
I'd like to zone in there on your mentioning of religion, because obviously Africa has played a very significant role in the history of many religions. How and why do you think that occurred? And what does that tell us about the continent's lesser known beliefs?
I mean, traditional African religions, I mean, I use the word religion advisedly because they are really belief systems, were there from the get-go. And they are still retained, even when somebody becomes nominally Christian or Muslim, you'll still find that there are traditional beliefs interlaced with their Christianity or with their Islam. But the continent of Africa has played host and has had and still has thriving communities of Jews and Christians and Muslims. And even today, I would say about 15% of the continent adheres to African traditional beliefs. And then the rest are sort of divided pretty much between Christians and Muslims. But you've had great figures in Christianity like St. Augustine, who was born in North Africa in what is today Algeria. And he, of course, is one of Christianity's foremost thinkers. You've got St. Anthony, who, of course, introduced the tradition of monasticism. So he's another great Christian leader. Ethiopia, one of the first nations to adopt Christianity as its official religion, and that was the case until the mid-1970s. And of course, Islam made huge inroads in Africa. So it is a bastion, really, for the world's major religions. The Jewish communities of Africa, North Africa in particular, have diminished over the years, but still, Judaism has strong roots on the continent.
The name Africa was coined by non-Africans, the Romans. And I just wondered, how much agency have Africans had over their continent's destiny?
Well, that's a big question, really. I mean, leading on from the name, it is true to say that once the Europeans arrived on the scene, the Africans did, to a large extent, shift into a kind of defensive mode, defending their way of traditional way of life, defending their territory, their land, which was often sequestrated by settlers, if there were settlers in their part of Africa. But I would hesitate to say that Africans were ever robbed of agency and just became kind of hapless, passive spectators to their own destiny. Africans have always resisted foreign occupation or influences which were not benign. They didn't take it lying down. And so they've always tried to make the best of a bad job. And I think that's what I admire so much about Africans. I mean, I know it's often said the resilience, but they have thrived in great adversity, seeing their populations, you know, decimated through the transatlantic slave trade or through exploitation later by colonial powers and so on. So when you think of a country like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, must have lost about 10 million people during the presence of the Europeans. So it is always, I think, very, very uplifting to just see how the Africans have survived that adversity and continue to do so to this day.
And that kind of leads me on to a question that I have about Great Zimbabwe, which is a very resonant part of your book. And you mention that this confounded European settlers who just could not conceive that this was built by an African civilization. Why has archaeology been so difficult in parts of Africa? And has this hindered a deeper understanding of its rich and diverse past?
I think, sadly, there hasn't been a lot of investment in archaeology on the continent of Africa. And by that, I mean governments in Africa have not really put a great deal of public funds into the study of archaeology or in big archaeological digs and trips, because it is quite expensive. You know, it's weeks and months and years of painful excavation, often in harsh terrain. And African countries have obviously favoured churning out doctors and engineers and so on, which they feel is better equipped to help them in their industrialisation drive. So I think archaeology, well, we know it has. And Dr. Weber Ndoro, who is a fantastic Zimbabwean archaeologist, has spoken about this and has written about this and said how there's just a handful of archaeologists trying to manage all the archaeological sites in Zimbabwe, for instance. And it's the same picture across the country. It's the same with the Sudan, where I was born. I mean, there are still treasures yet to be unearthed. And the amazing Swiss archaeologist Charles Bonnet has dedicated his life really to Sudanology. And he says there will come a time when Sudanology will be as well known as Egyptology, but that still isn't the case. So climatic reasons, lack of budget, perhaps a lack of prioritisation of archaeology has meant that we are still unearthing Africa's great history. Eritrea, for instance. When I visited Eritrea and one of the old sites at Kahato, the wonderful guide there was tapping his feet, saying to me, look, you know what, there's lots more to be uncovered in this territory, but Eritrea is a country that struggling to develop and so on won't be able to invest as it should in uncovering its great past.
Do you think there's been a perception of archaeology as almost being synonymous with the coming of European colonialism?
I think that archaeology really, I suppose, in Africa began with Egyptology, when Napoleon and his soldiers, accompanied by scholars, went to Egypt and they uncovered the Rosetta Stone and all the rest of it. And that's when Egyptology really began to develop. And that really fired up an interest in Europe, particularly in archaeology in Africa. So it has often been the domain of Westerners. But that has really changed, I think, in the last few decades. So you now find that there are very well-known Egyptian archaeologists like Zahi Hawass, for instance. I mean, there's nothing wrong, obviously, because knowledge is universal, and it's wonderful that these people took the time to use locals to help them uncover and excavate all the things that they have done. But I think that it's right that Egyptians are now in the lead and are the ones who, through the Ministry of Antiquities, uncovering their country's great past. And they've become the real repository of knowledge. I think that there has been a tendency outside of Africa and even inside Africa to see ancient Egyptians as being somehow separate from the continent. And that is something which is also felt in some quarters in Egypt itself. And that could be because from the 640s, Egypt was conquered by the Arabs and they perhaps influenced the way that the people there, once they mixed with them and so on, defined themselves. But as far as I'm concerned, I do say quite clearly in the book that ancient Egypt is part of Africa's story, an integral part of its story. And perhaps what one should do is, rather than question that, is to question why we have a certain stereotype of what an African is or what an African looks like. And it does revolve to some extent around ethnicity. And as I describe in the book, Egypt's pharaohs would have been, over the centuries, a range of appearances, really, ranging from the fairer to the darker and so on. And if you look at some of ancient Egypt's greatest monuments, the temple at Karnak, the Valley of the Kings in Luxor. This is fairly far south in Egypt. It's in southern Egypt, not along the Mediterranean, much more going in towards Sudan. And so it is very much part of Africa's story. I think that there is a bit of a resistance to seeing Egypt like that, but it's something I hope that will be overcome.
I was particularly struck by the fact that Amun-Ra, I believe, his birthplace, was actually quite deep into Africa in what is now Sudan.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the major deity Amun-Ra was believed to reside in Jebel Barkal, which is in northern Sudan, and the Egyptians believed he resided there along with the Sudanese, so the ancient Sudanese, or northern Sudanese at least. And so, yes, absolutely, Amun-Ra was the ram-headed god who resided in what is northern Sudan, which has always territorially never been part of Egypt.
Now, moving on to the transatlantic trade in enslaved people. How did this impact Africa, and how can we balance it with the centuries and multitude of other stories from the continent's long history?
I do think we shouldn't reduce Africa's history to just the transatlantic slave trade, nor start Africa's history from the transatlantic slave trade. I only get to the transatlantic slave trade in chapter 14 of my book. So that tells you that there was an awful lot going on before the transatlantic slave trade began around 1510 by the Portuguese along with the Spaniards. So I do think that, for example, some diaspora Africans, particularly African Americans, often do pivot towards slavery as being the defining aspect of their history, and they don't particularly look at their history before that. And so I'd like to say to them that actually they have a fine history that ages before predates the transatlantic slave trade. Having said that, of course, it was very much a defining chapter of Africa's history, because when you remove the fittest, the strongest, the youngest of people from a country or a region or whatever, then you are going to really have a huge impact on that place's development. And so taking away 12.5 million people from the 1500s until slavery was abolished in the early 1800s is going to have a huge impact. So it did set back Africa's development. It also severed social structures. It also set people against people, because sometimes you found that coastal people would cooperate in some ways with the transatlantic slave traders by transporting people to the waiting ships on the Atlantic, because they couldn't obviously moor right by the shore. They were too big. So it really has had, I think, an impact on the continent and its psyche. And that has persisted to this day. And I think also it evokes dealings today in the language of racism, whereby slavery was based on the idea that Africans were inferior, and therefore it was all right to dehumanize them and pack them into slave ships and cheat by jowl and really treat them in a very inhumane way. And I think that when people discuss the issue of racism today, that it is really, you can see its roots go back to the slave trade when Africans were seen as subhuman.
And I suppose that leads me on to a question about Africa itself. How aware were the different groups, cultures, civilizations across the continent of each other? For example, the Berbers and people in Sudan. Was there any awareness of different cultures existing in different parts of this vast landmass?
Well, I mean, Africa's always traded with Africa, within Africa. So you had the Trans-Saharan trade, which would link North Africa with other parts of the continent, what we would describe as sub-Saharan Africa. And also Africans traded with China, with India. We know that from archaeological finds that show that there were goods from these parts of the world. So I think Africans were aware that there were obviously different cultures because there are different languages. There are so many languages in Africa. It's the most varied of all the continents in the world. So linguistically, ethnically, racially. So I think that's what makes the continent so fascinating. And certainly the Africans throughout the millennia would be aware that there were different cultures residing in this continent.
We've kind of touched upon this already, but I would like to ask you, to what extent did the rise and fall of European colonialism across Africa contribute to the sense of Africanness among the various nations and cultures on the continent?
I would say that although Africa is made up of a multitude of ethnicities and cultures and languages, it was and is united by the fact that they all suffered either from foreign invasion or from colonial occupation. By the end of the 19th century, only Ethiopia and Liberia were sovereign, and I say in inverted commas because Liberia was still very much in hock to various corporate interests and Ethiopia was subject to attack by the British who tried to invade and also by the Italians later. So I think that unity has really brought about a sense of Africanness, regardless of which part you're from. One of the first trips abroad that a newly liberated Nelson Mandela made in the early 90s was to Algeria. So there you had a South African independence leader making a trip all the way to the north of Africa in a sign of gratitude because the Algerians had gone through their own war of independence, a very, very difficult one, a very bloody one, and they had given support to the South Africans. So I think that there you have two countries at opposite ends of the continent, and yet there was this common experience and sense of unity.
Now, in recent years, there has been a push to decolonize the curriculum and reassess our approach to history, of which the Rhodes Must Fall movement was emblematic. On average, Africa is home to some of the youngest people on the planet. And I'm curious to know how the upcoming generations are engaging with their history today.
I would say that Rhodes Must Fall, the phenomenon that we saw in South Africa around 2015, 2016, it started there and then it kind of became contagious. And you saw campaigns in Western universities here in the United Kingdom that said we ought to decolonize our history curriculums. And I think it displays a very real hunger by young people, especially Africans, but not only Africans, to have a more honest and more rounded perspective of African history. And I think that when you are taught Africa's history in a certain way through the eyes of the conqueror, then you get a very different history from the one when you listen to the accounts of those who are at the receiving end. So it's not a sort of contested history. My history is better than your history. It's just a more balanced view of history. It's not trying to supplant or replace. It's just adding to the accounts that we have. That's how I see it, at least. So when we saw the Rhodes Must Fall campaign saying we don't want to see history only through the eyes of Rhodes, I think that's a very legitimate exercise. So in my book, I not only look at Cecil Rhodes, but I look at the African kings who were within his orbit, like Lobengula, for example.
That was the award-winning journalist, broadcaster and filmmaker Zainab Badawi, whose book, An African History of Africa, From the Dawn of Humanity to Independence, is out now, published by W.H. Allen. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.